Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Legal recreational marijuana is coming to the first state, but that doesn't end concerns about black market cannabis.
At a time when Delaware is putting together its regulatory framework, you've got this flood of products that really sort of act like they're the same and they're not.
We delve into a new report on the dangers posed by illegal cannabis sales in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about DIAA's decision to move some high school championships from the University of Delaware. Art's Playlist looks ahead to the one-man cabaret NPR's Ari Shapiro is bringing to Wilmington. And Enlighten Me explains why you shouldn't rake up leaves in your yard this fall. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As Delaware ramps up for legal recreational marijuana sales, a new report finds that illegal cannabis, containing harmful contaminants and unknown synthetic cannabinoids, is being sold at high rates at gas stations and smoke shops across the first state. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with registered nurse Laura Barrett, founder and executive director of the National Clinical Director Consortium, and Chris Lindsay, director of state advocacy and public policy at the American Trade Association for Cannabis and Hemp, to take a closer look at the report's findings and the dangers of black market marijuana.
All right, Laura, the new secret shopper report that we're talking about today has found some concerning things regarding illegal marijuana, what comprises it, and the rate of it being sold in Delaware. In most cases, these products were publicly pulled right out of jars and placed into bags without labels, mainly at smoke shops and gas stations. There's a lot to sort through here, but let's get right to it. Can you give us an idea of, you know, some of the report's key findings?
Yes. Thank you so much for wanting to have this topic, wanting to talk about this really important information for public health. So the highest level overview was 83.3% of all of the samples were not Farm Bill compliant. It's the bill that allows these products to even exist, and 83.3% of them were not even Farm Bill compliant. 23% included harmful contaminants, like that we have science behind and research behind are harmful for human consumption. 63.3% included synthetic, like converted cannabinoids that are not natural cannabinoids. And of all the 30 products, 19 of the products' labels that were analyzed, 100% of them had elevated claims on their label versus what was actually in them, whether it was about potency or cannabinoid content, or that it said they were or weren't on 0.3% or less THC. And then many of the products didn't have any kind of warning about intoxication or anything about who should consume this product. So that's the highest level overview.
For our listeners that don't really know what synthetic or unknown synthetic cannabinoids are, can you give us kind of a breakdown on what exactly those are and why they are a pretty massive health concern?
When we have a marijuana plant, of course, it includes a lot of cannabinoids. It's famously got well over 100 cannabinoids, and they all have different or can potentially have different effects. Delta-9 THC is probably the best known of all these cannabinoids, and it's the one most closely associated with the feeling people get, that high feeling when they consume marijuana. Obviously, that molecule, that Delta-9 molecule, can come from nature. But what we've also found is that you can start with other cannabinoids in the marijuana plant or the hemp plant. They actually are the same plant. You can start with non-intoxicating cannabinoids and actually go through a laboratory process to strip parts of the molecule off and add new parts and actually get to a Delta-9 THC molecule through that process. Well, the issue that we have is that it's not natural. And in a world in which there are no standards at all at the federal level and states are starting to put standards in, there are really big questions about what happens during that process. What chemicals actually get introduced into these substances. And by the way, you're not really ever only making things like Delta 9, you're making a lot of other synthetically produced chemicals that, frankly, we don't know anything about them. Like, we have literally no idea what to even call them. And so when we have an unregulated system and we have synthetic THC products that are now just getting put directly into candy, sold on the internet, there are obviously big questions about the health and safety impact of this wave of products. And that's why we believe very strongly that they have to be part of a state regulated system. That's the only chance that we have right now of getting standards in place. And that's a theme that we see happening all across the US right now.
Something like fentanyl wasn't found in these products specifically, but that's also been something we've seen in the news that's cropped up in recent years in terms of, illegal or street marijuana being laced with fentanyl. But, I guess that's part of the point of this report, right? If it's sold illegally like this, you don't know what you're getting. It's not regulated, as we've made clear. You're at the mercy of whoever is distributing it, right?
Well, that's right. And it's not surprising that in a situation in which we have basically no regulation related to an intoxicant that is part of the same, at least extended family of marijuana, there's a lot of underground illicit activity that suddenly can sort of get in the mix. So if I'm an illegal marijuana producer, why don't I just call myself hemp? Right. And at least now law enforcement has to figure out what I'm up to. And how hard is that when you've got a lot of this stuff happening all around the US? By the way, if I wanted to distribute fentanyl, why don't I just spray it on top of hemp, call it hemp? Now I'm another challenge for law enforcement. How do you play whack-a-mole fast enough when we're in a situation in which we just have no rules?
And to Chris's point, like things like THCO, which is and Delta 8 synthetically derived cannabinoids, I work with patients. I mean, I work one-on-one with people, and I've heard story after story after story about additional health conditions that are unexplained, headaches and side effects, especially for people that are already sick, already have autoimmune disorders and issues. And then they're trying to use these products to feel better, and then they're feeling worse.
I'll say that even though Delaware isn't fully on board in terms of legalization like other states are, these findings and the relevance of the black market are in lockstep with what we're seeing in states where cannabis is legal. That is to say, illegal marijuana is still a big business. The head of enforcement for the California Department of Cannabis Control, Bill Jones, recently said that, and I quote, "The black market is still very pervasive, and it's definitely larger than the legal market," end quote. Over in New York, the legalized marijuana rollout has been a mess, which we've talked about here on The Green recently, and which I'm sure you're aware of. Retail sales there are reportedly dominated by illegal smoke shops as the state struggles to license legitimate ones. Governor Kathy Hochul has even publicly pledged to crack down on the illegal sellers. In Maine, the congressional delegation has asked the Justice Department for help in combating illegal cannabis producers who outnumber the state's licensed operators. So this is a big issue. And Delaware is not in the fully fledged legalization space that other states are. So what do you think Delaware can do to avoid those pitfalls? Or is this just a challenge that Delaware is struggling with now and will inevitably struggle with when recreational sales are fully legal?
Well, you know, states have been legalizing cannabis in various ways for some time now. You know, this actually goes back to 1996. It was really in the teens that we started to see a lot more attention going to things like how businesses operate. And it was really during that time that we saw the standards really ramp up. So once you started to get into sort of the 2015, 2016, we started to see states have very robust systems. And frankly, those have rolled out in very predictable ways. In many of them, there's not been a lot of drama. What has changed is the introduction of these new products that have appeared on store shelves in gas stations and in smoke shops and very often online that live completely outside of these regulatory systems. And suddenly now we have products that to most consumers really kind of seem like they're about the same thing. You know, you pick up a bottle of Delta 8 and you read it, and it sure sounds like somebody put it together and cared about things like labels and accuracy. But in reality, there are no rules at all about these products. You know, in the United States, we sort of expect that if we walk into a store and pick up a product that we're going to plan to ingest, that it's gone through some kind of system to approve its use. And that's not where we are when we get into the realm of hemp-derived intoxicants. Now, many states are starting to put rules in place, but at the federal level, there are no sideboards whatsoever. There's nobody setting standards for testing or even requiring testing. There's nobody looking at the labels. There's nobody doing any enforcement. And so states are really kind of now struggling to respond, and they respond across a broad spectrum. You know, in Delaware, a lot of these products are already illegal, but because they get introduced at a time when the state's changing its marijuana laws, and you got a lot of folks out there making false claims about this stuff is just magically federally legal, even though there are many red flags that different agencies have raised. That creates a real environment for confusion, and that's really where we are right now. So, at a time when Delaware is putting together its regulatory framework for natural licensed cannabis, you've got this flood of products that really sort of act like they're the same, and they're not. They're made in a test tube and not grown out of the ground. And that really changes things when we start talking about regulations. So we're in a, it's really a law enforcement challenge right now, and it's not unique to Delaware in any way.
Let's say you live here in a state like Delaware. You enjoy marijuana for whatever reason. You like it once in a while, you like it often, whatever. What would you recommend to those Delawareans? You know, what do you recommend they do in navigating this space as far as purchasing safe, healthful, reliable marijuana goes? Do they forced to go to other states where recreational sales are legal, like a New Jersey, like a Maryland? Should they, you know, maybe pursue a medical license? You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, certainly medical license is probably the best. Then they don't have to leave the state. It would be part of a regulated system. And to be sure, there's a lot of attention. You know, some folks complain about how expensive it is for these companies to be involved in these systems. And the reason why they're costly is because of all the health and safety requirements that have been layered on top of this type of activity. And so if you're dealing with a person who has a condition, they really ought to be in a regulated system because that's what they pay attention to. Apart from that, you know, it's since Colorado first legalized for adults, folks are accustomed to sometimes you got to go to another state. And that's kind of where I'm at because, again, there's no rules when you're dealing with illicitly produced products. You don't really know what's in it because there's no testing or anything else. And so for consumers, I think you got to stick with natural and stick with the licensed states until Delaware can come online.
Thanks to Laura Barrett, Executive Director of the National Clinical Director Consortium, Chris Lindsay with the American Trade Association for Cannabis and Hemp, and R. Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, we look at the decision to move some high school sports championship games away from the University of Delaware and UD's reaction to that move. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Interscholastic Athletic Association recently announced it is moving the state's high school football and field hockey championship games away from the University of Delaware, primarily citing the cost of holding football title games at Delaware Stadium and field hockey finals at UD's Rulo Stadium. DIAA is taking football to Delaware State University's Alumni Stadium in Dover and Abyssinia Stadium in Wilmington later this fall. and field hockey to Drass Field on DSU's downtown Dover campus, formerly Wesley College. State tournament finals in other sports like basketball, volleyball, softball, and swimming and diving will remain at UD venues. But some bitterness seems to be lurking beneath what seems to be a straightforward financial decision, with UD posting publicly on social media its disappointment with the move and laying out how much profit DIAA made last year with its events at UD. News Journal Delaware Online sports writer Kevin Tressolini has been following this story, and earlier this week I sat down with him to discuss what's going on and where things could go from here. So we'll start with this. I mean, this is not a surprising move. I mean, you and the News Journal have reported back in May that UD and DIAA were talking about ways to bring the costs of holding the events at UD down for DIAA, and those costs had jumped in recent years, correct? That was kind of the crux of this whole issue.
Yeah. I'd written that story in May, just kind of talking about how expensive it was and how much more expensive it had gotten over the last few years to hold DIAA championships at the University of Delaware. Football was the one in particular that the DIAA kind of thought, well, you know what, is it worth what we're paying, and is it even the right spot? Because Delaware Stadium is so big, it seats more than 18,000. You know, they only get 1,000 or two for the Class 1A and 2A games. The 3A games, you know, you can get a bigger crowd. Like the year Smyrna's been there, there's been pretty nice crowds. But it's still only about half the capacity. And DIAA Executive Director David Baylor told me that, you know, that they also think about the atmosphere that's there, you know, in terms of the crowd and that kind of thing. And you know, maybe would it be better off having it in a smaller venue just to kind of have a better atmosphere? But yeah, the price of Delaware Stadium went from $41,000 in 2021 to $57,000 in 2022, and then $71,000 last year. Now, there was an extra day added last year because they went 2 days instead of one. But that was kind of the root of the DIAA's thought about, maybe this isn't the right spot for it.
And normally that would just kind of be the end of the story, right? That it's like, okay, DIAA had financial and some other reasons for doing this, but then the University of Delaware had this kind of weird response to it, a social media post that expressed it was disappointed, then proceeded to specifically outline the profit DIAA made holding football and field hockey finals at UD. Is there any indication of the people you talked to at UD, like why they went this route?
Yeah, it was kind of odd. And that was what I wrote in the column that I wrote about it. It was odd and unusual for Delaware to do that. And of course, the irony of it is that here's the University of Delaware, which maintains this we're actually a private school approach and doesn't let out a lot of its financial information and spending information. And then they're going online and spouting what the DIAA is profiting. And the DIAA is open about its financial dealings, you know, with all the things that they got to do. What I think was important to point out after that happened was profits are important to the DIAA because profits from state tournaments comprise, I think it's roughly 85% of their budget. So they have to profit from their state tournament events. And obviously, if they're thinking about moving it, then they must not be making the profit that they like. Now, again, you know, football's the only one they're moving out of there. Now, field hockey's not going to be there this year, which David Baylor said was really because Rulo Stadium wasn't available. And, you know, the others are going back, and field hockey will likely be back there next year. You know, basketball, swimming, softball's there now. Will continue to be there. And the DIAA does feel like those are the right spots for those events. And I guess they do profit because, again, profits are really important for the DIAA.
I was going to say, I guess that's what made it so weird was that, you know, obviously DIAA, they've got to not just think about whether they're profiting or not, right? I mean, and that's what UD was like, okay, well, you made money. What's the problem? And DIAA, I'm assuming Dave Baylor saying like, yeah, but we need to make more than that. Like we need to like maximize
this. Yeah, because the cost was too high for football games at Delaware Stadium to be profitable enough. You know, so they're moving the Class 3A game to Delaware State, which is really the perfect size venue, the perfect location, being in the middle of the state. for the 3A game. The 1A and 2A games are going to be at Abyssinio and Wilmington, which of course is a great stadium, fairly new. Parking can be a little bit of a challenge sometimes there when you're parking in a forest. But, you know, that's for the 1A and 2A games. And it's going to be a long hike, you know, for the Indian Rivers of the world, who might be there. It is a nice venue. It is a nice venue. And again, I don't know what the DIAA is paying to use those venues for their events, but they must feel like we can make a better profit at those.
In fairness to UD, I mean, it's possible, even maybe likely, that their costs to open the stadium and have it available have gone up. But it's kind of hard to know that because we really don't know a whole lot about the inner workings of how their operations athletics works.
Right. And when I did the story in May, saying how DIAA was considering moving the football out of Delaware Stadium, Chrissy Rawak did say that to me, that their costs have gone up. They've got to deal with, you know, union employees when it comes to custodians and other people who work at the stadium. You know, they're dealing with the police in terms of security and things like that. So their costs have gone up, and that's understandable. And Chrissy did say that was part of it. And, you know, and to the University of Delaware's credit, they were working, you know, with the DIAA to try to make it as inexpensive as possible. But I guess it wasn't enough.
I was going to say, you mentioned that Dave Baylor had talked about some of the other factors involved here in terms of the atmosphere and things like that. Can an argument be made even beyond the finances that there are some net benefits from, as I think Dave Baylor said, spreading it around, like trying some different venues, making these more accessible to fans in all parts of the state and things like that?
Right. And I think Dave wants to try to get more involved with Delaware State. You know, they now have Mike Drass Field over there at the old Wesley campus, which is now the DSU downtown campus in Dover. That's a fabulous facility. I covered some girls soccer DIAA games there years and years ago. That's a great facility that you can use for DIAA events. You know, at times they've talked with the people who operate Chase Fieldhouse, you know, the group that runs that organization, about maybe having things there. They've talked to Wilmington University. Dave says they've talked to Goldie Beacom. So I think they would like to use some college facilities. And I think it's really good for the colleges because it introduces some people who may not otherwise see a campus or see a venue that, hey, look, you know, look at our place. This isn't too bad. This isn't too bad either. You know, and that Wilmington Stadium on Route 40, you know, that has not been used for any DIAA events. You know, they really get a lot of out of it at Wilmington University. But, you know, I think Dave would even like to kind of get, you know, to know those Wilmington U people a little bit better, to see if, you know, they can maybe make use of some of their fine facilities.
And I guess the flip side of that from UD's perspective, and maybe this informs a little bit of their decision, is the idea of like them moving things away from UD takes away from UD kind of its branding of itself as kind of like the University of Delaware. You know, that when you think of Delaware, you need to think of the University of Delaware. Do you feel like that maybe plays a little bit of a role here, that perhaps the school would prefer to be the true flagship of Delaware universities and colleges?
No doubt about it, Tom. And they are the flagship. Right. You know, it's a bigger school. It's a better school than all the others. It is a flagship school that we're all very proud of. It's one of the best colleges in the country. They have great athletic facilities that they've done a lot of things to improve. You know, right now they're building a new softball stadium. Mm-hmm. And that's where the DIAA championships will continue to be. It was great moving it over there 2 years ago. That's been a great spot for it. It's going to be even better now when they get the thing upgraded. There's bulldozers and cranes and things like that down there right now, getting that place redone. I think Del, and you could kind of read between the lines of the University of Delaware's social media post last week to kind of see that they feel that way, that, you know, we are the big dog. They did seem a little bit spurned. They were acting kind of spurned about the whole thing, that, hey, you know, what do you mean? We're the, You know, we're the place where you're supposed to have all this stuff. And they will continue to be, as they should be.
And I was going to say, I'll end on this. I mean, obviously, I guess the ultimate goal here is to make it the best experience for the student athletes. And sometimes it is playing those basketball finals at the Bob. That has always been a very special thing. But maybe, as you said, a smaller venue to make the crowd feel bigger at a Delaware State University for football does that for football. And I guess that's ultimately what Dave Baylor and DIAA's goal is you've got to make profit, but how do you make it the best experience for the kids who are playing in these games?
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a balancing act there, Tom. As you suggest, no doubt about it. You got to make a profit. You want to make as much as you can, but again, you want it to be the best possible experience for those who are involved, the students primarily, and that's always kind of been the way the DIAA has looked at things. You know, certainly that has been the case, as you said. I mean, the Carpenter Center is just fabulous for those big basketball games. It's not even big enough, really. It seats 4,500 now or something like that, and they could put even more people in there for the boys basketball finals and semifinals. So that's always been a great spot, you know, now for geez, 30 years since the Carpenter Center opened. That's been great. And they want to continue to do that. But yeah, again, sometimes, you know, when you're in Delaware Stadium and Tatnall's playing the Charter School of Wilmington or whoever they played in last year's final and you know, there's 2,000 people there, maybe a smaller venue is better for something like this.
Thanks to News Journal Delaware Online sports writer Kevin Treslini for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist and our conversation with Ari Shapiro, co-host of NPR's All Things Considered, ahead of his solo cabaret show Coming to the First State. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The co-host of NPR's All Things Considered, Ari Shapiro, is bringing his one-man cabaret show to the Baby Grand in Wilmington. Thank you for listening. Adapts narratives from Shapiro's best-selling memoir, The Best Strangers in the World, into a litany of stories and songs about the power of listening to bridge divides. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Shapiro for more on Thank You for Listening.
Well, let me start by asking, what can we expect to see and hear in this show?
Well, it's a cabaret, which means there are stories and songs, and some of them might be things that will be recognizable to NPR listeners, because I do talk about my day job at NPR, hosting All Things Considered, and some of the adventures that I've had in that role. But I go a little bit deeper into my own personal life and experience. I hope it's really a funny show and hopefully moving and touching. And I've just started doing it in the spring and summer of this year. And so it's been really satisfying to see audiences react to it. But it kind of weaves together a lot of different threads because, as you may be aware, my day job is as a journalist hosting All Things Considered, but I do a lot of other things too. I sing with the band Pink Martini, and I hosted a Netflix reality competition called The Mole. And so this cabaret show kind of weaves all of those together into one hopefully amusing narrative.
What inspired you to put this show together and also use the cabaret format? What helped you settle on that?
I love cabaret as a format. Long before I ever started doing it myself, I was an admirer and fan of people who perform shows that feel vulnerable and personal and unexpected and take audiences on a journey. And then a few years ago, the actor Alan Cumming and I created a cabaret show together that we have been touring around. That show is called Och and Oy, and it's basically the two of us cracking jokes and telling stories and singing duets. He's always had a solo cabaret show on the side for many, many years, and he's had several of them over the years. And I started getting the itch to try to do something similar. And what came out of it is this show, Thank You for Listening, that, you know, it's scary, it's challenging, it's vulnerable, it's personal. And so when an audience responds to it, it feels that much more rewarding. I had a friend once say to me that he thinks that a lot of American performers, this friend was a Brit, he said he thinks a lot of American performers confuse cabaret with musical revue. He was saying a musical revue is just kind of a bunch of songs strung together with patter in between, but a cabaret needs a reason for existing. It needs to have a thematic arc, and it needs to end someplace different from where it begins. It needs to take audiences on a journey. So that's always been the bar that I try to clear with these kinds of shows, and hopefully this one does it.
Can you talk a little bit about designing and preparing this show? How do you go from an idea to a finished product?
Yeah, it's funny because I had a long weekend writing retreat with my musical director, Henry Kapersky, who plays the piano in this show. And I came into the writing retreat with a general arc for what I thought the show was going to be. And I had kind of sketched out the beats and the songs that I thought were going to be included in the stories. And over the course of this long weekend working, Henry and I basically collaboratively swapped out each and every beat and story and song with something different, something I think is better. And so it was a pure collaboration. And I think that if I had come into the writing process with a blank page, it would have been a little bit terrifying. But being able to come in with something that was a concept, maybe not fully fleshed out, maybe not very good, and then beat by beat, line by line, song by song, joke by joke, improve it, was such a kind of satisfying process of discovery. And then we did the show for the first time together over the summer in Provincetown, Massachusetts, in this lovely old little venue. And it felt appropriate because Provincetown has this long history of being a place for artists. And after we did the show there a couple of times, we figured out what was working and what wasn't. And we made some changes and swapped a few things in and swapped a few things out. And so now I'm really excited about this version of it that we're bringing to Wilmington on October 5th. And I hope people there love it.
There's a postcard in your office at NPR that's going to play a role in the show. I don't want to be the guy who asked you to spoil it, but can you talk a little bit about that postcard and what it says?
I'm looking at it right now, sitting on my shelf. The image is tulips in a vase. And the stamp is a dove of peace. And the postcard says, "Dear Ari, please butch up. I find a daily dose of your personality annoying. I'm a person too." I will tell the story in the show of how this postcard came into my possession, why it sits framed on a shelf, and how it fits more broadly into my love of hate mail, and even more broadly into the phrase, "Thank you for listening." But I'm going to save some of those details for the show itself. I don't want to spoil anything for the audience.
You've sung professionally in front of tens of thousands of people at the Hollywood Bowl and at other places. That's a huge crowd, but it kind of pales in comparison to what you do every day at NPR. How do the two experiences compare, performing in front of a live audience in person versus the sort of performative aspect of anchoring All Things Considered?
You know, radio is such an intimate medium. It doesn't matter whether hundreds or thousands or millions of people are listening. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, I am just talking to you. It's a very one-to-one conversation. And performing in a venue that has thousands of people in the audience, there's an electricity to everybody sharing an experience. So when the whole audience laughs, you feel everybody sharing that experience together. There are sometimes moments in my cabaret show where I feel like the silence is so profound that I know I could give a little twist and suddenly the mood will change. Or if what I'm saying is very kind of vulnerable and fraught and loaded, and then suddenly I drop a joke in the middle of it, it's like you can feel the tension release. That's something you don't get on the radio because you don't have everybody in the same room. But maybe counterintuitively, I find performing at a place like the Baby Grand more intimidating than performing at a place like the Hollywood Bowl. Because when there are 18,000 people in the audience, it just becomes kind of a faceless mass. And yes, everybody's having the same experience together, but it is so big and so far that it just becomes kind of a sea of humanity. And at a place as intimate as the Baby Grand, you really feel each other's presence in a very specific, individual, acute way. And it feels like we as individuals are all experiencing something together. Whereas the Hollywood Bowl is thrilling and epic, and you know, it's got this long, proud history, but it doesn't feel quite so much like we're all in on some kind of secret that we're sharing.
That's such a wonderful way to put that. Your day job at NPR is not exactly a 9-to-5, 40-hour-a-week kind of proposition. How do you make the time to keep your singing chops up when you're working crazy hours and also putting in the pretty intense emotional labor that journalism requires?
You know, I once read that there is something scientifically documented about, and this is going to sound like it has nothing to do with your question, but I promise it does. At the end of a meal, when you feel very full and the waiter says, "Can I interest you in dessert?" And you say, "Oh, I'm totally stuffed, but yeah, I do have room for dessert." There is something about different appetites that is real. And so I find when I'm coming off an intense journalistic experience, like this summer, I was at the DNC and I was hosting All Things Considered from Chicago. And then I flew to Los Angeles for those shows at the Hollywood Bowl. And the DNC was exhausting and singing at the Hollywood Bowl is thrilling. But there's something about having those different appetites for those different kinds of self-expression where each one kind of fills the tank in a different way and uses a different enough set of muscles that I feel like one kind of primes me for the other and sets me up to be ready to do the other. So that when I'm on tour with Pink Martini or Alan or doing my solo cabaret show for a week, it may be exhausting, but when I come back to the newsroom, I feel energized and rejuvenated and ready to plunge back into the news in a way that I might not if I had just been laying on a beach for a week.
I think most of our listeners know you as the voice on All Things Considered or previously as a White House correspondent for NPR, this authoritative voice that delivers the news, often not great news to us. In Thank You for Listening, the audience is going to get to maybe know you on a more personal level or in a different way, at least. What do you hope your audience will come away knowing about you that they might not know right now?
Well, fundamentally, I am an optimist, and I really believe in the best in people and humanity. And that is not despite the stories I've told as a journalist. It's because of the stories that I tell as a journalist. And so I hope that over the course of this show, people not only come to understand why I have a positive lookout on life and the world and people, but why they might consider looking at the world in a similarly positive, optimistic, hopeful way. I mean, I don't think that my optimism is naive. How could it be when every day I'm reporting on everything from climate change to wars to natural disasters? But I do think that my optimism is earned and grounded in reality. And that's something that I hope comes across in this show.
And finally, Ari, before we go, I want to wish you a happy early birthday. It's coming up at the end of the month, just a few days before you hit Wilmington.
That's right. September 30th, a Libra cusper. But well, as I say in the show, I have feelings about horoscopes, but it's one of my most favorite lines in the show. So I'm not going to deliver it right now. People will have to come to the Baby Grand in Wilmington on October 5th, and they can celebrate a belated birthday with me.
Thanks to the co-host of NPR's All Things Considered, Ari Shapiro, and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on the latest edition of Arts Playlist. Ari Shapiro's One Man Cabaret, Thank You for Listening, comes to the Baby Grand Saturday, October 5th at 8 p.m. And we wrap up the green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn more about why you should leave the leaves alone in your yard this fall. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us all on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The autumn season is underway, and with it comes fallen leaves of orange, yellow, and gold that blanket our yards. That also typically brings the long and tedious process of raking and bagging leaves. But what if taking the lazy way out means a healthier, more environmentally friendly yard? In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon talks with Susan Barton, professor of plant and soil sciences at the University of Delaware, about the benefits of leaving the leaves alone this fall.
Fall is here. I think we've turned a corner in terms of weather and getting away from those summer temperatures. The leaves are starting to change color and they're starting to fall, which is the crux of our conversation today. It's safe to say, I think most people will rake up and bag their leaves, but you and certainly others say that we should just leave them. Why is that? What's the thought process behind leaving the leaves?
So leaves are a wonderful resource of nutrients and organic matter that comes from the trees. So if they're bagged and taken away to a landfill, not only are you filling up landfill space, but you're wasting that resource. Now, I will say that you can't just leave your leaves on your lawn all fall long, because those leaves will exclude light and they will prevent the lawn from photosynthesizing, and you can get dead patches in your lawn if you know, have a thick layer of leaves covering your lawn. So you do have to remove them from your lawn, but what you should do is you should either leaf blow them or rake them into a surrounding landscape bed. You can also mow them up and chip them in your lawnmower and then take that bag of leaves and place it on a garden bed, a vegetable garden, a landscape bed, or a compost pile. Early in the fall, while you're still cutting your grass, you can just cut your grass and let the leaves filter back down into the lawn. That's also fine. As far as in the landscape bed, you definitely don't want to rake the leaves out of those landscape beds. You want to just let the leaves decompose in the landscape beds. If you think about it, a forest is one of the richest environments that we know of, as far as, you know, good, healthy soil and open soil with a lot of pore spaces. And that's because the leaves just fall off the trees in the forest and they decompose and make that leaf litter layer, and they go back into the soil.
Yeah, so it's going back into the soil. Can you expound on that a bit in terms of what exactly is happening here in leaving the leaves? You know, they're decomposing into the ground over time. Like, what's happening there, though, in terms of, you know, the benefits or the environmental benefits?
So a couple of things. The leaves contain nutrients. There's nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium in the leaves. Those are all things, as well as micronutrients and others. Those are all things that plants need to grow. So if those get put back into the soil, they get retaken up by trees and shrubs and perennials and all the other things that are growing in the landscape. So you don't need to fertilize when you are putting the leaves back onto the landscape. Besides that, the leaves contain organic matter. So organic matter is something that improves soil a lot. At least in the mid-Atlantic, we tend to have clayey soils unless you're on the coast, and then you're going to have more sandy soils. But if you have clayey soils, organic matter will help the clayey soils to create aggregates, which allow your soil to have both large pore spaces and small pore spaces. So water can drain better out of the soil in the large pore spaces, and nutrients can be held in the soil in the small pore spaces. And that's ideal for any plant growing. You need that balance between air and water. In a sandy soil, the organic matter also helps because it fills pore spaces between the sand particles and allows nutrients and water to be held better. So we talk about organic matter as being kind of the magic sauce. It helps both a sandy soil and a clay soil. There's another component to the benefits of leaves and organic matter, and that is that leaf litter layer provides a place for overwintering insects. And a lot of people say, well, I don't want my insects to overwinter, they're pests. Well, only about 2% of all of the insects in the environment are pests, either to humans or to plants. You know, 98% of the insects are really important, and they feed our birds and lots of the other organisms that we want to have in the environment. But if there's no leaf litter, there's no place for a lot of those insects to overwinter. And so you don't get the bird food in the spring that you really need for those baby birds to be fledged.
Let's say we do this then. We leave the leaves as they fall. Will the leaves eventually, you know, they'll decompose into the lawn, but will they'll disappear? Or I'm guessing there'll be like remnants left over that you have to get rid of at some point?
I have seen many landscapes that use chipped up leaves as their mulch. It's one of the most natural looking mulches. It's so much more attractive than dyed wood chip mulch, like that orangey color mulch or the really dark black mulch is really unnatural looking. So leaves can be a perfectly wonderful mulch. I personally like the look of it when they're chipped up. So, what I do is I get a landscaper to dump piles and piles of leaves that he has been forced to collect from some of his clients' home landscapes. He dumps them in a big pile at the edge of my garden and then chips them, chips them up with a piece of equipment at the very end of the season. And then I have this pile of wonderfully small pieces of leaves that form a perfect mulch next spring when I go to mulch all my landscape beds. Now you can do that yourself as well by either if you have a leaf vacuum, you can vacuum the leaves up, it will chip them up and make this fine mulch, or you can do it simply with your lawnmower. Put a bag on your lawnmower, run over the leaves, and then you've got this chipped mulch that you can use in your landscape beds. And if you've got beds that are large, you might want to leave the larger leaves in the center of the bed and then just use this finer chipped up mulch at the edges of your landscape beds.
Well, I'm not necessarily asking for a pep talk here then, Sue, but I can see how a lot of folks out there will have a hard time, I'd say, getting over the aesthetic of just leaving their leaves in their lawn or their yard. So what would you say to those people who maybe they do believe in all the benefits you've talked about today and the environmental benefits, but they just can't get past the aesthetic of all of those leaves, or maybe not complete coverage, but at least partial coverage or whatnot? What would you say to them to perhaps inch them in the direction of not raking and bagging up their leaves this fall?
Well, so I am a supporter of raking or mowing up leaves that are in the lawn. First of all, you're going to have a nice green lawn because you are going to remove the leaves from the lawn. Just the way you remove the leaves from the lawn that makes the difference. If you put them in black plastic bags and leave them at the end of your driveway, they're going to go in a landfill. But if you chip them up and use that chipped up mulch or leaves as mulch, then you're reusing that resource. And I think people will find, especially chipped up leaves, is an extremely attractive mulch. Now, one of the things I recommend to people, if you say to me, well, I have so much lawn and so little bed space that I'm not going to be able to spread all the leaves that I've taken off my lawn on my limited bed space, then my response would be, you need more bed space. You don't really need that much lawn. I mean, we need lawn to play on. We need lawn as a gathering space. And we need lawn as circulation around the landscape. So our lawns should be purposeful in the ways that we use lawn, rather than just the default vegetation of the home landscape. And it's a paradigm switch for how you think about your landscape.
Thanks to UD Professor of Plant and Soil Sciences, Susan Barton. and R. Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and DPM senior producer Kyle McKinnon. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.